Welcome back to the Make or Break Show, where each week we bring you stories of incredible makers and the make or break moments that have defined them along the way. I'm your host, Brandon Cullum, and this week we chat with Jen Schachter about her work on massive collaborative projects with Adam Savage, including Project Egress for the 50th anniversary of the moon landing. What is up, everybody? Welcome back to the show. Hope you are doing absolutely amazing on this wonderful Thursday. If you're listening to this when this goes live, we have a really fun and interesting interview for you guys this week. We're going to be hanging out with Jen and talking about probably a project you've seen popping up a good bit here, especially over the last couple weeks, and then especially over the next week, as this is to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, which is going to be next week following the date of this release of this podcast. But before we get into that, as always, I want to thank all of the awesome and wonderful supporters that we've got over on Patreon. If you'd like to support the show, you can head over to patreon.com/makeorbreakshop. So I've changed it up again. That's patreon.com/makeorbreakshop because I'm including some rewards for my actual YouTube DIY channel at the Make or Break Shop on YouTube. And one of the things I'm going to be rolling out here in the next couple weeks is the Fusion 360, so the 3D models that I make for my projects. I'm going to be releasing those to the different levels of support there, in addition to some plans that I've already created at higher levels over on Patreon. All right, so jumping into this week's interview, we're hanging out with Jen Schachter today. She's actually calling from the Cave, which is one of the more famous, I would say, maker locations in the country, if not the world. That is the home to Adam Savage in San Francisco. Jen actually works on his team, and she's been there for a couple months. But I first heard about Jen's stuff from this Project Egress that has been going around for a while. So a week after the date that this releases, so mid-July, is the 50th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing. And they've been doing this really cool collaborative project where the hatch, they call it the egress, basically. There's been about 40 some odd makers that have been 3D printing, using woodworking, metal, all different types of stuff, and putting these parts together. And at the Capitol, I think in the Air and Space Museum, they're going to be putting all of this together. Just has this really cool collaborative project with makerspaces all over the country. Folks that have been on this podcast before, like the folks over at I Like to Make Stuff, as well as Jimmy DiResta and Evan and Caitlin, they have all been contributing. So it's been really cool to see people do these projects, but Jen was kind of the person spearheading it, putting it all together, being the project manager. And so I wanted to bring her on to talk about these projects specifically. She's actually done some other ones in the past, one including We Are the Rosies, which was this really cool 3D printed collaborative project that was a massive Rosie the Riveter that they did a few years back. So we get into that. And then also, Jen is part of the team that has been working on the new show Savage Builds on Discovery Channel, again with Adam Savage, where he is just building some crazy stuff. You guys have probably seen it. If not, you probably have seen promos for a flying Iron Man that's been 3D printed out of titanium, which is just as insane as it sounds. And so she's actually in that a little bit. She's part of the kind of the team working on the actual projects, which is really cool to see. But Jen is an incredible maker in her own right. And in addition to all of these crazy collaborative projects, she has a really deep art background, and so she brings that sense and sensibility to all of her projects. So without further ado, let's jump into our interview with Jen. All right, guys, welcome back to the Make or Break Shop. We're hanging out with Jen Schachter today, calling in from Oakland, California. Maker extraordinaire. I feel like you coordinate tons of makers. You probably know every maker in the world. But thank you so much for jumping on and chatting with us. Looking forward to getting into your background and your journey in the maker world. So
thanks so much for having me. This is cool.
Yeah. So one of the things I love to ask people, especially that have a lot of different skill sets, is how do you, like, if you're at a party, how do you tell, what do you tell people you do if they aren't kind of in this world?
That's a good qualifier. Oftentimes, if people ask what I do that aren't, I just say I'm an artist, and that's enough.
Okay, cool.
But within the realm, I guess I've kind of been telling people that I sort of mastermind big community builds. That's sort of my primary focus at this point. But I've worn a lot of different hats. I teach sometimes. I was teaching at a local tool library in Baltimore. I write safety manuals. I do some of my own, you know, sort of creative, weird build projects. And I just started working for Adam at the Cave in San Francisco. So I wear a lot of different hats.
Yeah, that's cool. And is that where you're at right now?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I feel like I was like that. A lot of that stuff looks familiar. So that's so cool. Well, I want to get a little bit into your background. Did you went to school for art? Is that right, or for mm-hmm. general?
Yeah, yeah. So I went to school for art in Baltimore, Maryland Institute College of Art, which is a mouthful, but we just call it MICA.
Okay.
And I studied fine art there, so I did a lot of painting and drawing and sculpture, did a little bit of film studies. And I don't do a lot of that stuff anymore, but it kind of informed my design aesthetic, I guess.
Yeah. How did you get into the art stuff? Like, were you always drawing and painting as a kid?
I think so, yeah. It was always making things.
Okay.
I took some art classes at a local painting studio when I was like 10, I think, and just got super into that. And I was always sort of crafting and building things for my toys when I was really young, and kind of came back around to the more making side of things as an adult.
Do you remember some of the things that you made way back?
Yeah, I used to make stuff. I made a lot of stuff for my brothers, like G.I. Joes. So I'd make them like tents and different props and build like environments for them.
Cool.
And then like maps of the house that was disguised as, you know, different locations, and built stuff with Legos, and I had, you know, dolls, and made them all kinds of like clothes and sleeping bags and like cooking implements. Like, you know, built out these little miniature worlds. Like anything that didn't exist that I wanted them to have, I would make out of, you know, plastic and junk that I found around, old clothes and things like that.
Yeah. Is there still stuff that you have from way back then?
It's somewhere in my dad's basement.
Okay. So it's not with you. So where else? The world building piece, it sounded like, kind of was a big deal for you.
Yeah. I didn't really think of it as making at the time. It was just something I did when I was younger. And then I got into fine art and realized more as an adult that I was more interested in creating physical objects and experiences than two-dimensional, sort of flat.
Yeah. Was that a weird shift? Because I feel like when I talk to people and they're talking about art, a lot of times, yeah, it is like the 2D stuff. But when you get into 3D structures, and that's almost like a different, I feel like, a mindset that you kind of have to get into.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, both from a sort of perceptual thing and also just like the world itself,
right.
You know, sort of the type of people that are in that realm are different. The art world, for me, I guess I got kind of jaded by, there's like the whole gallery scene, and you have to produce a lot of work and have a, you know, a gallery representing you. And the sort of trajectory of being a fine artist wasn't something that appealed to me. And so partly for that reason, and partly I just felt compelled to make more objects than pictures, I suppose. I think the art world tends to be about like making something look nice or making something about how you feel. Whereas building things is actually just making the experience that you want to have.
Yeah. What were some of the projects you did in art school?
Let's see. I did a lot of painting. I thought I was going to be a video sort of minor concentration.
Okay.
So I did a lot of film classes. I did some 16mm film, which is really cool.
Oh, cool.
We had a professor who brought in all of his big like Steam Deck machines that you could, you'd like, place the film strip on there and actually splice it and tape it together, like really old school. I think towards the end of school, I started doing more sculptural stuff. So I made a series of, I guess, sort of like dioramas out of found objects and like weird sentimental items that I created into sort of little lighted boxes. And it's very hard to explain without seeing it. It was super, you know, artsy-fartsy, but that's where I started to get in more like sort of sculptural, physical object
direction. Cool. Literally, like right before we got on, so I just watched half of Stranger Things that came out, mm-hmm. I guess, last night. And so I was like, I want to make a light box, and I needed an excuse to do something cool. I'm like, I want to do like the Stranger Things poster. So I was just an illustrator, just like cutting stuff crazy out. But that stuff is crazy cool. So when you got out of art school, did you Like, did you go into it thinking I want to be like a career artist and going the gallery route and all that kind of stuff? Or did you know that kind of wasn't the route you wanted to head towards?
To be honest, I didn't give it a whole lot of thought, like what, where I was going to end up. I think when I was 18, I was just like, I want to do art things, but I didn't think too much about where that was going to place me. And that was the first problem. you know, 18-year-olds don't necessarily have a lot of foresight. But I, you know, soon realized once I got into school that, I don't know, I think that my people that I found kind of in the maker realm afterwards, I fit much more with that community than the art community specifically. So
how did you get into the maker world, quote unquote?
It was sort of a zigzag path. I didn't really know that it was a thing, I guess.
Yeah.
So I went to art school. I did a stint waiting tables and, you know, doing a bunch of freelance design stuff on the side. And there was a sort of an art gallery space in the restaurant I was working at. So I offered to sort of curate the art shows there. And so I took that on and I was working with local artists and curating a bunch of different artworks and putting them up and framing them and putting them up in this gallery space. And from there, I got a job, a corporate job working at Under Armour, the sports apparel company. Visual merchandising for them. So kind of like writing instruction manuals and dressing mannequins and that type of thing.
Yeah.
Totally was not a fit for the corporate world. And then I decided to switch over to nonprofits. And there's a group in Baltimore called Baltimore Corps, which is sort of like Peace Corps, but it's based in the city. And I got a job with through Baltimore Corps, got a job at a youth makerspace in Baltimore called Digital Harbor Foundation. And it's a youth tech center. They teach summer programming and after school programming and everything from like 3D printing and laser cutting to circuits, digital fabrication, all that kind of stuff. So I was working there, and within the first week there, they had like all weekend hackathon. Like overnight, building stuff. And then the whole crew, like the whole staff, went to Maker Faire. And I remember at that moment being like, oh, these are my people. Like, this is where I was supposed to be. And so that was probably like 4 years ago. Then kind of just discovered that that's what I had been doing all along, but didn't realize that there was a whole movement around it.
What was it about that environment or those people where you're like, these are my people?
I don't know. It's very, kind of scrappy and DIY, and the idea of like, teaching yourself how to, learning how to develop skill sets that you wanted without necessarily having a formal education. Not to say there aren't formally educated makers. You know, there's certainly machinists and engineers and, tailors and carpenters. Like, there's so many different skilled trades. But I think the thing that really appealed to me was that you could access all of this learning, and teach yourself and kind of make it up as you go, which has always been, despite having an art background, that's sort of how I've done the maker side of things. That and the level of, passion and commitment to building things, with each other. I think the maker community has a really great ethos of sharing and collaboration and things being open source. And, it's just a really great community.
Yeah. Yeah. When I did, engineering in college, and, I went into it thinking like, I want to build actual things like with my hands. And then like, I worked for General Electric for a little bit doing like aircraft engines, but it's all like 3D models of this like super tiny part. And I'm like, I just want to get out there and like get like a saw and a table saw and something to play around with. I thought I was going to be like a maker as an engineer, but I was like, no, I need to actually do something a little bit different. And I'm super jealous because I feel like the maker spaces are a lot bigger deal in colleges, at least when I was there. So how long did you work then at Digital Harbor Foundation?
Let's see. I think I was there for a little over a year. So the Baltimore Corps kind of terms where you're placed in a community sort of business or nonprofit for a year. And I think I stayed just a little bit past my time there, and then started work at another foundation locally at a makerspace focused more towards adults, which is OpenWorks in Baltimore.
What what's the, I mean, I know the difference is the people that are coming, but like, do you, how do you approach programming and teaching for kids versus adults? Like, is the adults more kind of like, here are the tools, you go figure out what you want to do with it?
It's interesting. I think, and it could partly be because of the different communities that I was working with, but I find sometimes with kids, you have to convince them why this is worth them paying attention to. In adult classes, oftentimes people seek those out because they're really excited about learning a new skill, and they're personally paying to be there, to be part of the class. And so, you know, you have various different levels of experience, but people are coming to it because they're really interested in learning the skill. Sometimes with youth spaces, and this is kind of a fun part of the challenge, but, you know, it's an after school program that their parents sign them up for or something. And you have to reel them in. You have to get their attention and like show them why this is cool. And almost always, you know, once it, and it depends, like sometimes it's a different unit for different kids, but eventually you'll get that spark, and then they're hooked, then they're like super sold on it. But, you have to first get them interested.
Yeah. Yeah. Was it like showing them like a final project or a, almost like with Legos, like this is, here's the front of the box. This is what you're going to make. Now, like, here are the instructions to get there.
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes showing them, like giving them an inspiration of like, this is what you could build once you like master these skills. And then other times it's, you know, everybody learns differently. And that's part of what's exciting about working with kids too. Like sometimes, it's a particular thing. Like I did a summer program last year, where we covered a bunch of different things. We covered woodworking, laser cutting, electronics, and you can see which kids sort of gravitate towards different things. Some kids are totally not interested in 3D modeling at all. But as soon as we started soldering, like their eyes lit up.
The, I feel like the digital fabrication stuff, were you exposed to that much in art school? Like were those type of tools around, or was that more like the makerspace once you got into it?
Definitely more the makerspaces. Because of the focus that I had in school, it was more fine art, more analog. I'm jealous of the young people that have access to all this digital fabrication equipment. I wish we had more of that when I was, we had just gotten a laser cutter that was like very hands off. You had to like submit your files to a tech, and only the tech could operate the laser cutter. And that was like the end of my senior year.
And so then you got pretty deep on the digital fabrication side of things. Like I know with the Make, you were part of a team that did a lot of like the review of like the new machines and everything, right?
Yeah. It was, it was a huge honor to be able to do that for Make for 3 years. When I was working at Digital Harbor Foundation, a bunch of our staff were part of the digital fabrication review team. And so every year they would meet, many years before I was involved, but they get in all the new digital fabrication equipment. I think it started as 3D printers, and then they ship them all to one location, and a team of experts or semi-experts get together and put all the machines through their paces and review them based on, you know, the build quality, the output, the software interface. So I started when I was at Digital Harbor, and then have gone back for the past several years to review mostly laser cutters.
That's cool. So I think I was listening to an interview you did, I guess late last year, when you were talking with the guys, well, it tested, but with, you were talking about how there were different tests for 3D printing, like the bridge and like standard tests, but you had to figure out a way to test laser cutters across the board. Mm-hmm. Like what did you wind up doing to do that?
It's kind of still in development, and I hope that we have, I hope there's future iterations of this, because it'd be a shame to just, you know, not have any digifab reviews. But we developed, for 3D printing, we have what's called a set of test probes. And they're basically just different prints that have been designed to demonstrate different functionality of the printer. So like a piece that has multiple bridges across to see how well the printer tackles that, you know, things that test for structural integrity. But basically they're just a number of prints, and those same probes are run across each machine. So when we were thinking about developing them for lasers, we were trying to think about, you know, what things do we actually want to compare, and what can we compare apples to apples across machines? So a few probes that I came up with, or that our team kind of developed, are a sort of a kerf test. So, you know, at the most clean focus that your laser can be, what's the finest kerf that you can get off of that machine? So we'd cut a few different shapes and measure the kerf. And, you know, you have to run enough tests to get a decent data set. Trying to think of what other probes we ran. Certainly cut and engrave, both for speed and quality. So we would set up a file and then time how long it would take the machine to run that full raster versus another machine, and then, you know, test the quality. Other things we're looking at are quality in different, like, areas of the bed. So sometimes a laser cutter will have sort of a sweet spot where it's got the best, you get the best results, whether because of the optics or because of the, you know, levelness of the bed. So we would test that in each of the four corners and in the center and kind of see how it does across the entire build, you know, the build area.
Yeah, yeah. I never even thought about that. I have like a 50 watt laser, one of those like from China. So it's like a bigger one where you have to like half read Chinese to get it working. Mm-hmm. But I never thought about the differences in the size or the area of the bed. I need to try that out. That's crazy. How did you measure kerf?
So we'd cut out a couple of different sizes of circles and squares and then measure the difference between the part that cut out, you know, the negative space and then the positive, and whatever difference, you know, times two, because for both sides, but whatever the difference in the size of the shape versus the size of the opening, that was the kerf determination.
Just with like digital calipers or something to get, that's awesome. What was the smallest that you guys found?
You know, fractions of millimeters.
okay,
I don't
super
remember
small,
offhand. Yeah. This was like two summers ago, I guess, was the last one. But you know, and the machines, like, it's hard because you know you don't want to say anything bad about anyone's machine because it could be really detrimental to their business. So you try to be diplomatic and talk about the pros and cons. But they all cater to different audiences. You know, like some machines are better suited for educational environments. Some are better for heavier duty production. So it just depends on what you're looking to get out of that particular machine.
If you were building out your own personal shop and you were buying some like DigiFab machines, like what would you start out with?
Are you talking ideal world? Like money is no object.
you have to pay for it, but like it's not like super bad to pay for it.
Okay. In terms of laser cutters, the Glowforge, I think, comes in cheaper than the other ones for their basic model. From a price perspective, that would definitely be a good option. I reviewed the M-Blazer, which is basically a Blu-ray player attached to a gantry. It's a diode, the diode laser. So it's not the CO2 lasers, the ones that we're familiar with. I think it's a fairly inexpensive option. It does really, really beautiful surface engraves.
M-Blazer, like E-M?
M-Blazer.
Mm-hmm. Huh, okay, cool.
But the Dremel DigiLab that came out is also a pretty great option. When I reviewed it, there were still some things to work through, but I think that they've fixed a lot of those problems. My biggest gripe with a lot of the laser cutters is the software, as I'm sure you've run into.
Yeah, like, it's horrible, yeah.
But there's a sort of open source, really cool software called Lightburn that was designed by someone who uses lasers and kind of knows what you want the software to be able to do. And I think that's like a really promising software connection to the different laser cutters. If that could be compatible with a lot of the existing lasers on the market, that would like totally change the game for other lasers that are maybe cheaper to be more user-friendly.
Yeah, I think that's what sold me, because I saw, it must have been Maker Faire in New York last year, they were set up with the K40 and they'd put a new controller in it. Mm-hmm. And then the guy that had made Lightburn was there showing me the software. And I was like, oh, wow, this is like, I understand you.
Yeah.
And like, I understand this. Like, this totally makes more sense versus what I thought I'd have to mess around with. But that's cool. So would you start with a laser cutter just in general versus like a CNC or 3D printer?
Probably, yeah. And I guess that's, maybe it's informed by my art background because of, I know Illustrator really well. So I do a lot of vector work.
Yep.
So laser cutting is just pretty straightforward to me. I've started getting into the realm of CNC, but even just in terms of space and how much of a mess you're making, like certainly laser cutters
are. Yeah.
Yeah.
I talked to a lot of kind of the YouTube makers that just put out tons of projects. And when I asked them of those like tools, what they use the most, most of the people still say the laser cutter, even if they have like a massive CNC or something wild. Yeah, they're like, I still wind up using the laser more just because you can do it so quick. The quality is super high, if they, especially if the software is good. You can just crank out this tiny little stuff really quick. So,
yeah. No, that surprises me to hear, actually. I'm thinking of people like April Wilkerson, who's got, you know, I think she's got a Laguna that's like giant workhorse. And I mean, I guess if you're a woodworker, like CNC makes more sense because you're already building like bigger structural stuff and have the setup to handle that type of, you know, dust extraction and all that.
I think it was, so Bob at I Like to Make Stuff was the one, I think I was asking more recently, because I mean, he has a massive CNC. I mean, he has everything, but he's like, yeah, that Glowforge, I just used a ton. It's super easy to use. But I want to talk more about your projects, because you've done some pretty wild ones. You made letters that went on the lawn of the White House, which is crazy. Like what's the background of that? And this is what, 2016? So a few years back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was kind of the project that kicked it all off, I guess, for me. I was working at Digital Harbor, and my former boss there, Andrew Coy, who founded Digital Harbor, he got a job working at the White House, on the Office of Science and Technology Policy, as an advisor. And so the end of the Obama administration, they were having a festival called South by South Lawn, which is a riff on South by Southwest. And they wanted to make these giant light up letters, kind of like the TEDx letters. And so I got a call from Andrew, and he was like, do you want to build something for the White House with Adam Savage? And I was like, yes.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of how it all started. And I had just started working at this new makerspace, OpenWorks, and used all their, you know, fabrication equipment to make all of the pieces of these sort of letter shaped cabinets. And then we brought all the pieces over to Digital Harbor, and 50 or so of the kids there, signed up to help. And Adam came to Baltimore, and we assembled and wired up these huge 7 foot tall letters, and carted them to the White House the next day for this festival.
That's wild.
And it was kind of the centerpiece of the event.
Was security crazy? Like, was it weird? Like, was it like Secret Service is like staring you down?
Yeah, it's an interesting process to get a big build thing into the White House, because they have to, of course, check everything, and this thing is wired up with all sorts of electronics and power supplies and stuff. They do it off-site, so you're several miles away from the White House. You have to bring all your things and Secret Service. They sort of separate you from your stuff. They bomb sniff everything. They, you know, whatever techniques they use to check it. And then they seal your vehicle. They lock the back of it and they flag it so that no one can like mess with it after they've checked it. And then there's an armored escort that drives you to the location. It's pretty intense. We waited for a couple hours, like, for them to go through everything. And
That's cool. Did you get to meet the president? Did you meet Obama?
I did not. That's one of my regrets, but I supposedly the letters are going to end up in the presidential library.
Oh, cool.
So I'm hopeful someday I'll get to be like, hey, what do you think?
That's gotta be one of the coolest places to have like your stuff in wind up.
Yeah. I think it's, you know, several years down the line, I'm pretty stoked about that. Yeah.
So how did you get involved with the Nation of Makers?
That was also kind of a like organic like connection that happened also through Andrew. So Andrew started Nation of Makers out of the Office of Science and Technology Policy. So it was sort of a branch of something they were working on at the White House. And then the organization became their own entity, their own nonprofit. And so when I was working at this other, the adult maker space, I started doing research about different spaces and maker culture and how different communities are built, you know, basically across the country. How are different maker spaces inviting people into their space? What type of community culture are they setting up? Different safety standards, all that kind of stuff. And so Nation of Makers, you know, there's different teams researching different components of those same questions. So I kind of just joined up to have those conversations with other people around the country.
That's cool. And for people that don't know, I mean, they basically support maker spaces around the country. Is that like research and everything, that kind of the idea to think through?
Yeah, it's a giant network. Okay. It's a network that exists. They have a website. They have a really massive Slack channel where people communicate about everything from insurance policies to risk management to anything and everything you can think of about running a makerspace and maker events as
That's
well.
Cool. So it's just like a full support system and resource. Mm-hmm. Are you still pretty active with them? Like, what's kind of your role with them now?
Unfortunately, I haven't been as involved as I would like to be. I feel very sort of connected to a lot of people there. We've communicated online for several years, and we got to meet last year at NAMMCON. I since then have picked up my entire life to move across country. I worked in a television show, started working here for Adam. So bandwidth has been really limited, but I'm hoping to get back involved with Nation of Makers soon because it's a really awesome community.
Yeah, and they had a conference in Chattanooga like fairly recently, right? Is that NAMMCON? Am I saying that right?
Yep. Yeah, NAMMCON year two was in Chattanooga this year.
So I guess it changes up each year. Like as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, different host city.
Got it. So you've mentioned moving across country a few times, and I feel like I see part of a big project that you're working on behind you. But these like massive like collaborative builds that you've done, was your first one We the Rosies? Like, was that the first one you kind of spearheaded, or was it before that?
That was the first like super, super huge one. We did, Adam and I did a sort of puzzle scavenger hunt for South by Southwest the year after the letters. And that was, I guess that was less of a community build as a community like participation.
Yeah.
So I made these lazy puzzle pieces and hid them, well, mailed them to different places in Austin. And then put together like a trivia scavenger hunt for people to solve a riddle and then go to the location and find the puzzle piece.
That's really
so it was,
cool.
Like, interactive.
Yeah, that's crazy. So these, for people that don't know, these projects with, is it We the Builders? Is that kind of the organization, quote unquote, behind it?
The 3D printed ones,
printed,
yeah. Okay. The big Rosie was We the Builders effort. They're working on another sculpture of Nefertiti for the Fab Foundation conference this year in Egypt.
Oh, wow. That's crazy. So the idea, though, is you take something and then you break it up in a ton of super tiny parts and you send it to makers all across either the world or the country, and then you put it all back together. Is that kind of the idea?
Yeah, totally. You nailed it. That's the concept. And it usually works. I mean, it hasn't not worked yet.
That's the logistics of that. This sounds kind of crazy. Like, is it... because for what you're working on right now with Apollo 11 and Egress, how many different makers are you guys working with?
This one's a little over 40. I think it's around 45 different, either individuals or spaces that are collaborating to make a piece for the hatch.
That's wild. Do you ever get nervous, or have you ever had where like this part's not going to work, or we got to like troubleshoot? Like, is that, I imagine there's got to be some crazy stuff you guys got to work through.
Yeah. I had this conversation with my dad actually this past weekend, because he was asking me, he's like, aren't you worried it's not going to work? Like, what if it doesn't work? There's a point in every project, especially these big ones, kind of high stakes ones, where I have a very real moment, or sometimes several weeks, of like, we're not going to pull this off. Like, this is going to fall flat on its face. But after, this is the fourth kind of big build that we've done now. I'm learning to trust the process, and like, also that's what I was explaining to my dad is like, it doesn't always end up being what you think it's going to be. Like Rosie came out actually pretty darn close to what I was imagining the finished product was going to look like. But there's a point in the process where you have to sort of let go and whatever quirks and things don't fit together. You make it work and you figure out the best way to represent it with what you have, like with the situation that you've got on your hands. And I think we've pulled them off so far. No, like, you know, there's always challenges along the way, but there's not ever a point where it's like, oh, well, she's not going to have an arm.
Yeah.
So we figure it out.
That's fun. And so that's going together in a couple weeks. that you guys are putting together. And it's yeah. in the Air and Space Museum. Is that right?
Yeah. It'll be July 18th. In the morning of July 18th, Adam, myself, and Andrew Barth, who is the CAD engineer on the project, the three of us will collect all the pieces, and we'll be on a central stage and building it in front of a live audience in the Air and Space Museum.
That's crazy. So this episode either will go out the week before or that actual day. And so people are, I'm sure, can need to follow along with all the crazy stuff you guys are going to be doing. I'm guessing there'll be lots of like follow-up videos and stuff too that people can check out.
Yeah, definitely. The Project Egress hashtag has been pretty active. So that's where all the contributors, they're posting their sort of process videos and behind the scenes pictures and stuff at that hashtag across platforms. And then the day of, we'll have a film crew there documenting the actual build. That video will probably come out a couple weeks later once they've gone through all the footage and edited it and all that kind of stuff.
Gotcha. Okay, so the last thing I wanted to ask you about was, so you mentioned a TV show. So you've been working, I guess, on Savage Build. Is that right? Behind the scenes. Have I seen you in some of it? Were you in, I feel like, the 3D printing one, maybe? Or the Iron Man suit, like putting stuff together? Okay.
Yeah, my hair is a little bit redder than expected.
Yeah, yeah. And like what I'm looking at is like a little tiny like picture too. So.
Yeah, I had that season is wrapped up for now, but the show was we shot from January through, I think they wrapped in late April maybe. But yeah, it was a big challenge for me, that one, because I've never worked on a TV show before, and it's sort of, it's the intensity of one of these big build projects, but consistently for 3 months, like every day you just eat, sleep, and breathe the show. But it was a lot of fun, and hopefully that, you know, comes across in the finished product that they put together.
Yeah. It feels a lot like Mythbusters, but like in the best way. It's like almost like if you took Mythbusters mm-hmm. and combined it with like the one day builds on Tested, I'm like, yes, this is exactly what I want to watch on like a network television show.
Oh, awesome.
What is it like? So you mentioned it's super intense, but do you guys think through builds differently because you know it's going for TV? And I'm guessing like you're wanting to have like a narrative or something to it. Like it's kind of the end package different the way you approach it.
Yeah. I mean, my role is very small compared to what the whole team is doing. You know, there's multiple directors and producers and, an entire production team. So there's lots of other people and lots of other points of view. But certainly they're, the producers have a narrative in mind when they're doing the build. So it's like, there's the actual thing that they're making, but then they're also concerned with how do we tell the story of this process along the way? Which is, as a builder as a project manager, oftentimes my main concern is just seeing the thing get made. But I'm not often the one documenting and making sure that we have a cohesive story to tell. So that's a whole other level of process to add.
Yeah. So what's kind of been your role so far or on the past season?
On the Savage Build? Mm-hmm. I was a builder, project manager,
gotcha.
Kind of fill in the blanks wherever stuff is needed. But yeah, we'll see where it goes. But it's a super solid team. A lot of the production crew is the same as Adam was working with on Mythbusters. So they've known each other for a decade and they work together really well.
Yeah. So now that you're in San Francisco and after, I guess, Project Egress is done, kind of what's your next step for you, or what are the projects? Or are you able to talk about some of the stuff that you're going to be working on?
There's some like small things in the pipeline. I'm interested in launching a channel. I have a couple ideas in mind for a few videos that I want to make, sort of build, but also sort of just like quirky, weird, performative sort of art things. So look for that at some point down the line. In terms of projects with Adam, I don't know what's next for us. Like I'll be here in the shop most days, so kind of whatever comes along the pipeline. But yeah, I don't have any. There's usually one a year. That's about the level of commitment I can handle to these like enormous, all-consuming projects. Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah.
Since you've done a couple of those massive ones, what's it like at the end? Like, do you have a favorite moment from those days that you actually build it? Like, is it when it's done, or what's kind of your favorite moment from the day?
Going back to talking about the point where you think it's like not going to work, I think the moment when you're in it, like when you're in the build, and you know, you're covered in glue or paint or whatever, and you kind of take a step back from the thing and look at it, there's a moment where you're like, we're going to pull this off. Like, this is actually going to become a thing. And it's looking good. Like, not necessarily, like the final product of course is like really satisfying, but that very specific moment where you're like, we got this. And you kind of marvel at how all these pieces came together and how it was even possible to get to where you got, that moment is pretty special.
Well, I'm definitely looking forward to seeing it all come together. Super excited. I know a lot of the people I've had on this show are building stuff and have already made the parts. And so it's been really cool to see. But for people that want to follow along, specifically like with your stuff and the things that you've got coming, any good places that you'd send them?
I'm pretty active on Instagram, just because visual. So I'm mostly posting pictures and videos. Shack Attack. It's SCHAC_attack. That was my nickname in high school, and it kind of stuck.
That's awesome.
So.
Well, sweet. Well, I definitely appreciate your time in chatting with this. So it's really cool to see all the master projects you're putting together. So
thanks so much. This was fun. I'm excited to see it come together.
All right. Thanks for hanging around to the end of the show. This is where I give you a quick update about the things I've got going on inside of my own shop. It's been pretty busy here recently. I've been working on a big butcher block countertop that I actually installed a little bit earlier this week. So the big thing with that, not only is the project done, but I am knocking out a video on the overall build process. I put out one last week that was on how I stained it. So I ran into a bunch of issues trying to get a really consistent stain on maple. So lots of blotching, a lot of different things that I tried. So still wasn't perfect at the end, but I have a video out right now over on my YouTube channel on the things that I did to make it happen. And I'm going to be putting out the actual build video later this week. And then also this week, I have been working on a new project that is going off of Stranger Things. Stranger Things, a show that came on Netflix, season 3 was last week, I think. Yeah, July 4th. And I absolutely love the show. It's been a blast. And I've been wanting a really good excuse to make a light box. Yeah, you might have seen these, especially on Etsy. They're really popular. But long story short is you just light a bunch of series of pieces of paper from the back, and the shadows create a really cool design. And so I found a cool piece of art over on Behance, Adobe's Behance, of Stranger Things. And so I have been working in Illustrator to get into a file that I can actually laser cut it. It's going to wind up being, I think, like 7 or 8 layers. And so I've been knocking that out this week. And then I'm going to be making a bunch of picture frames and shadow boxes for it next week to actually use as a light box. So that is what I have got going. And I've got lots of updates over on Instagram at the Make a Wreck Shop if you want to see what I am working on. And as always, I'd love to see the things that you guys are working on, and I'd love to feature them in the future. So I hope you are doing absolutely amazing. And until next time, go make or break something in your shop. See you guys.